The aim is to let the corporation, Citizen General Electric, do what he wants to do, when he wants to do it, the way it wants to, whether it's a good idea or not. They pass these laws that are sham laws. I mean, first place, the teeth are all pulled out of them, but they may sound pretty good. And then, of course, once they pull the teeth out of them, they either don't fund the agencies enough to see that the laws are carried out, or the agencies are filled full of people that make sure that they're not, that the intent isn't carried out, or they put people in the Supreme Court to make sure that none of it works. Foreign governments, Japanese and whoever else you might want to talk about, have better access to our representatives than we do.
What role is there left for the people then?
Well, every 4 years they get to rubber stamp one or the other of Tweedledum or Tweedledee. It's as simple as that. And then the day after the election, we go back to lobby practice and payoffs and corruption and bribery as usual.
So the people who are the power elite doing the work for the ruling class, they set the agenda for what you see on the media, what you are taught in school, where philanthropy money will go for, the whole thing. It's all one big system. Until the American people realize this and face up to it, they're not even going to know what to oppose, much less be successful in struggling to make any change.
During the 92 election, the reporters frequently accused people of fomenting class warfare if they talked about the rich. Or we're going to talk about the class warfare which the rich have waged against the rest of us right now on Alternative Views.
...1992 was a real good year for muckraking books, trying to open the eyes of the American people as to what has happened to them. The American people are kind of like that old frog in the pan. They say if you dump a frog into a pan of boiling water, it'll jump back out. It doesn't want to get boiled. But if you put a frog in the cold water and then slowly raise the heat of it, the dumb frog would just sit there fat and happy until it dies. So let's hope that some of the people will read these books. Well, here's a new one by William Grider called Who Will Tell the People? Now, Jack Hopper, our economic consultant, is going to discuss this with us. We had previous programs where we talked about other books that have come out like America, What Went Wrong? And The Overworked American. But this Grider book is quite comprehensive in indicating what has happened to the American people and the American democracy and the whole economic system and class system in the country.
Before we have our interview, let's have some news, starting with what's happening in Iraq, considering George Bush's second war against that country.
On December the 27th, an Iraqi plane was shot down south of the demilitarized zone in Iraq that the U.S. and the U.N. had established as a line beneath which the Iraqi military was not allowed to fly. Well, immediately after that, there were reports that the Iraqis put up a whole bunch of threatening missiles on the border of the demilitarized zones that threatened U.S. planes that were flying patrol in that region. Well, Bush threatened Saddam Hussein once again, saying that if the Iraqis did not withdraw those missiles, that there was going to be war. another strike at Iraq by the U.S. And after about several days of cat and mouse, the Iraqis appeared to have withdrawn all those missiles. The question now is, was this really a threat to U.S. planes flying in that region? And according to Christopher Bellamy in The Independent, which is a British newspaper that's quite reliable, on January the 9th, these missiles were not at all formidable by modern standards. They were hardly a threat to the U.S. planes that were flying over that region. They were S-2 and S-3 Soviet-type missiles deriving from the 1950s that really didn't have the range or the accuracy to threaten U.S. planes that were flying patrol in the region. Moreover, Bob Simon on CBS, who's actually in Iraq right now, reported that he heard from diplomats that were independent of the Iraqi government, foreign diplomats in Baghdad, that these missiles weren't even on the demilitarized zone line in the first place. They were a set of missiles that were the first line of defense for Baghdad in case the U.S. or the coalition troops fought Baghdad again, so that there was possibly an exaggeration of the threat to U.S. planes from the Bush administration to try to keep things at a hot temperature in that region. Well, just after this crisis cooled off, it was reported over the weekend of January the 9th and the 10th that the Iraqi military invaded Kuwait again. They did an incursion over the border and they robbed some Kuwaiti weapons and took them back to Iraq. By the 11th of January, it was reported that there was a second raid, this time by Iraqi civilians or military people that were in civilian uniforms, and it was again claimed that they had stolen weapons from the Kuwaitis. Well, the story that once again both Bob Simon of CBS and the CNN reporter gave, who were inside Baghdad, was that this was both military and civilian hardware and material that was taken out of the demilitarized zone between Iraq and Kuwait that was set up by the United Nations, which was a region that previously belonged to Iraq. In fact, it was their only seaport, the Umm al-Qasr, that was taken away from them by the United Nations and made a demilitarized zone under the command of the United Nations.
Actually, we can say that the U.S. is trying to manipulate Kuwait here, because historically Kuwait has never coveted Umm al-Qasr, but now after the war, in revenge for the war, they want to get a hold of it.
So the Iraqis simply sent some people over there that they claimed were not military, that were just a civilian trucking company, to take material that they thought belonged to them away to Iraq, because it was now in a demilitarized zone that was no longer part of their sovereign territory, and they denied that they had taken Kuwaiti weapons or that they'd done any incursion into Kuwait. The only newspaper that I've seen that actually reports this is once again The Independent in Britain. This information has not come out in any of the U.S. newspapers, although it was reported on CNN and CBS. So we still don't know what the facts are in the latest crisis between the United States and Iraq. And as we are reporting on the 12th of January, there's even threats that the U.S. is going to bomb Iraq again because of this incursion.
If we look at the history of Umm al-Qasr, you can see this is set up for instability. Since 1913, when Britain arbitrarily divided the border between Iraq and Kuwait, there's been problems here. The border's never really been settled, and also it's never really been settled to the satisfaction of Iraq. Umm al-Qasr right now is the only city that Iraq has, or had, with ready access to the Persian Gulf. Now, Iraq, being an export-oriented nation, since it's dependent on its oil fields, needs a port city to export oil out to the rest of the world. Right now, they don't have any access for when the embargo is over, and hopefully they'll start trading with the world again. So Kuwait, they'll have to go through Kuwait, and there's already a great deal of hostility and animosity between Iraq and Kuwait. So it could be that the Iraqis are just trying to exert their national sovereignty over this area for pretty legitimate economic concerns, i.e. the fact that they need to have access to the rest of the world.
It's a much more complex situation.
In fact, this situation could create a flashpoint for hostilities well into the future, well after Saddam Hussein is gone. Because when you set up borders like this, where countries don't have access to the things that they need, you're going to create a point of tension. And this is basically what British policy has been in Africa and India with the creation of India and Pakistan, and here in the Middle East with the severance of Iraq and Kuwait and the Persian Gulf access.
Some weeks ago, when the U.S. first sent troops to Somalia in December of 1992, I speculated that the U.S. may be interested in setting up a military base there because of the proximity to the troubled Persian Gulf region of Somalia. The U.S. at one time had a base there, that which they abandoned, that actually put them in a good situation to do a military intervention anywhere in the Gulf region. Well, I recently read an article called Somalian Adventure, Squeeze Play on Yemen, that is a variation of this interpretation. I got this from PeaceNet. According to this article, part of the explanation for the quote-unquote humanitarian military intervention in Somalia may lie right across the Gulf of Aden to the north in Yemen, in which there are heavy interests that have really not been articulated by the mainstream media, and a threat that Yemen poses to the more conservative Persian Gulf states. You might remember during the crisis in the Gulf, Yemen and Cuba were the only two countries that opposed the UN resolution to allow force to kick out Iraq from Kuwait, and Yemen paid a heavy price for that. They lost $100 and some million aid package from the U.S. The Saudis were so angry that they kicked out 1 million Yemeni guest workers, therefore increasing Yemen's unemployment rate to a catastrophic 40%. And traditionally, there's been a lot of tension between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and now with this unemployment situation, the U.S. may need a military force there in case they invade or cause trouble with the more conservative Gulf states. There was something else in there that I never heard of, and that is that South Yemen is full of what is called elephants, that is an oil industry term for gigantic untapped oil fields. So there may be major oil finds in Yemen that would also make it very helpful to have a U.S. base in Somalia right across from Yemen in case U.S. interests wanted to move on those oil fields. Now, as for what's going on with the U.S. military action in Somalia, there were very contradictory reports the weekend of January the 10th and 11th on the mainstream media. The same day, I saw an ABC report that indicated that everything is going just great, that the U.S. is ahead of schedule, that the morale of the troops are high, they're going to get out any day, that it's just a really successful U.S. Military intervention. The same day, NBC gave a very downbeat report saying that the troops were very upset, their morale was bad, they didn't know how long they were going to have to stay there, they were tired of getting shot at, they were surprised and shocked that they weren't being received as liberators and heroes. There was also an article in the Washington Post about black troops that were serving in Somalia who were very disturbed about the racism of their white colleagues, and also were disturbed that the Somalians weren't being more friendly and receptive to the U.S. Mission in that country. So it's simply unclear what's really going on, whether this is a successful or an unsuccessful U.S. military operation, whether it's about to wind down and the U.S. troops are going to be brought home, or whether this is another quagmire where there's going to be an increased involvement of U.S. troops there. And the U.S. interests have never really been articulated for this. So it may have to do with geopolitics, things like the U.S. wanting to have a base in that region, which would indicate that the U.S. is going to be in Somalia for the long term.
Doug, Representative Howard Volpe, a Democrat of Michigan, in these Times story, said that the Carter and the Reagan administrations have much of the brunt, or should bear much of the brunt of the responsibility for what's happening now in Somalia, because it was the U.S. that propped up this incredibly oppressive regime of Siad Barre after the Soviet Union abandoned him in favor of Ethiopia in 1979. And this was also then in 1989, the Bush administration made a concerted effort to help the defense, U.S. defense contractors market overseas. And there were American export guarantees of up to $1 billion in commercial loans so that there could be all these arms transported overseas. And so what has happened is the third world just awash with all these weapons. And we see what has happened in Somalia, where just about every male over the age of 12 has an AK-47. But it's getting worse, according to In These Times, that many of the new arms, the state-of-the-art arms, which have been sent to these third world countries, are so simple to operate that somebody can use them with just a minimum amount of training. For instance, they say that the new tank which the Americans have is so simple that a retired Pentagon officer recently said it makes a tanker out of a herdsman or a farmer. You can just ride in it and grow and drive off and start firing the dadgum thing. And so with arms like these, even the most technologically backward countries can become military threats to their neighbors, or, and as we see in Somalia, to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's join Dr. Jack Hopper, our economic consultant, and see what he has to say about Grider's book, Who Will Tell the People?
What's happening in Washington, certainly we know happened in Austin, Texas, with the state government years and years ago. And we had only hoped that it wouldn't happen in Washington, that there were factors keeping it from taking place up there. But in state government in the state of Texas, the lobby owns the legislature. Nothing passes up there unless the lobby wants it passed. And that wasn't the case in Washington, but apparently that is the way Washington is now.
Well, Grider's book has subtitled The Betrayal of American Democracy. What does he mean by this?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the Beltway. There's a lot of talk about the insiders in Washington. And it's now becoming so obvious to everybody that nobody plays the system up there. Nobody is in the system except those people that are around government, meaning the tremendous number of lobbyists that are there now. These are the people that are controlling, running government. These are the bag men that pay off the legislators, the congressmen and the senators, and in turn get their enacted laws or kill their enacted laws. And it's a combination of money and influence in Washington that shuts out the rest of the country, meaning all the voters.
And then what role do the two parties have in this? It used to be that parties represented grassroots from the top, from the bottom right up through the top, and then there could be some reflection of this in policy or at least attitudes on the part of the Democrats. But Grider says something different now has happened, real revolution.
Well, the parties don't mean anything, of course, in terms of how they affect people and voters and the public. It seems to me that all they are anymore is the organization that puts together the nominating group and holds the convention. And it doesn't really have anything to do anymore with who's elected. The party used to be the place where the nominees for the presidency were selected, but not anymore.
Grider calls this mock democracy now.
Well, he calls it a lot of things. He calls it pseudo. He calls it mock democracy because the day after the election, the voters are put back into their boxes, and they're not asked or consulted again for four more years.
Right up at the front, Grider talks about something which Americans consider a no-no, particularly the American press and even academia. That is class structure and class conflict. He says that there's an American ruling class and that it has just taken over all of the power, and the American people are just completely shut out. This is, and that elites are those that are in the positions of power, and regardless of which administration is in. This
or which party you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That's right. Both parties are indistinguishable in terms of the power structure, the payoffs, the lobbies. In fact, the lobby groups up there are all mostly law firms, and they have their Democratic people, and they have their Republican people. And so they've neutralized the whole party system by making no differentiation between parties.
Grider talks about in his section on realities of power, he uses the term hollow laws and clientism. What does he mean by hollow laws?
Well, this is a trick that our government plays on us, Democrats and Republicans, and that is they pass these laws that are sham laws. I mean, first place, the teeth are all pulled out of them, but they may sound pretty good. And then, of course, once they pull the teeth out of them, they either don't fund the agencies enough to see that the laws are carried out, or the agencies are filled full of people that make sure that they're not, that the intent isn't carried out, or they put people in the Supreme Court to make sure that none of it works. And so the public has been told, as they were with tax reform, hey, we're going to make these fat cats pay. Well, they didn't. They made the poor people pay more and let the fat cats off even more than they had been. And in 81, 83, 86, all those so-called reform periods in tax law, the public was told that the public was going to benefit when there was never any intention of having the public benefit. And the public didn't even know about it. All they knew was, after a few years went by, something was wrong. And something sure was wrong. They'd been lied to, and it was a sham, mock set of laws that were put on the books.
And Grider talks about random law enforcement, too.
Well, random law enforcement, of course, is where selective agencies pick the pieces of the law they want to enforce or not enforce. And essentially, the law enforcement is more or less left to private groups who have an interest in making sure that the law is enforced.
And isn't there a section on corporate power where it shows that the corporations themselves are the biggest lawbreakers in the country? And even if they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar, the most they ever get is a slap and on the wrist, and that doesn't hurt them at all. Or they'll get a consent decree where they didn't admit they did it, but they said they won't do it again.
Well, that's been the case for 100 years in this country, since the corporations, particularly the railroads, became dominant. And they, in turn, made sure that the laws didn't impact them very much. They, in turn, made sure that the laws weren't enforced that had a very negative influence on them. And we had the antitrust laws that were more or less meaningless, except from few times. And Grider has a whole chapter in here on what he calls Citizen General Electric. Citizen General Electric, which is probably the biggest law-breaking corporation we've ever seen. It's over and over fined and cited for breaking laws and evading laws. It has a whole lobby. It has a whole army of lobbyists in Washington to make sure that the laws that are passed are favorable to it. And so General Electric has the benefit of being treated as a citizen, as a private citizen. That's the way the law in this country treats corporations. And even if these corporations are criminal, they're not treated like criminal people and stripped of certain rights. They're allowed, on the one hand, to pay minuscule fines and then go ahead and contract with the government to screw the government like they had been doing in the past, or to break the laws again.
Meanwhile, the people who should be responsible, the chief executives or the people on the board of directors, get a free ride and are off scot-free.
Well, that's right. And once in a while, they'll convict or they'll charge a corporate officer with some wrongdoing when it was so egregious that they can't avoid it. But there have been very few General Electric people treated like that. And that's what it takes. They're going to throw some of these GE people in the slammer so they'll take some of the laws seriously that they're breaking.
What does Grider say about the performance of the media?
Well, the media, of course, is a business. And then you begin to look at it in terms of the same attitudes that other businesses have. And that is to make sure that the corporate world is dominant, to make sure the business world is dominant, to repress workers and eliminate unions. And it also has concentration, of course. The concentration of the media means that there's less diversity. And even more ominous is the fact, for example, that Citizen General Electric owns the NBC network. And there's not any way the NBC network is ever going to say anything adverse to Citizen General Electric.
or the regular or the interest that it has, like the
Kidder Peabody and Wall Street firms. It's got, you can't even keep up with all the interest that this conglomerate General Electric has, and all the interest around the world that it has, but and in military spending and in military contracting, it just goes on and on.
What role is there left for the people then?
Well, every 4 years they get to rubber stamp one or the other of Tweedledum or Tweedledee. It's as simple as that. And then the day after the election, we go back to lobby practice and payoffs and corruption and bribery as usual.
And Grider talks about what's impudent, what's his term, impudent demonstrations or something like that. That's the only role that people have. They can't get on the regular media. And so they have to go out and sass cops or carry signs around. That's the only way they can try to get their word across.
Well, they do two things. One is, of course, they developed a booming business out of talk show hosts. And the talk show hosts let these people sound off and give their opinions that can't be given any other way. And the other is some smart entrepreneur picks it up sometime, like Ross Perot did in the last election, and sees what the concerns are and begins to play on this sentiment that somebody from the outside needs to get in there and clean that mess up.
Grider talks about a real revolution where, for the first time, he says, the Democrats and Republicans are collaborating now. This is a point that you alluded to a while ago, that there doesn't seem to be any friction among the two. It's just all one big smelly, slimy, corrupt pot up there.
Well, of course, the meeting point for that slop jar is the lobbies in Washington. And, of course, the lobbies in Washington are made up of law firms that are Democrats and Republicans. And, of course, they've got their clients. And the Democratic members of these lobby groups hustle the Democratic members of Congress, and the Republican members hustle the Republican Congress. And they're all bribing them in terms of PAC money and contributions. And it all turns out the same. It all turns out the same way. And it makes no difference because what's driving the process is money, campaign contributions.
I guess the most egregious example of this corruption and how it goes unpunished is the savings and loan debacle.
Well, Grider uses the savings and loan disaster as, in effect, that's where his title come from. Who will tell the people? He asked, who told the people that this mess was a danger, and that this mess was starting, and that this mess was continuing, and that this mess was going to cost $500 billion? Nobody.
Except alternative views. Isn't that pathetic?
Well, nobody pathetic? In Washington, yes. And not enough people are seeing and watching, Frank. Yeah. But nobody in Washington. And, of course, for example, the fact that Republicans and Democrats alike were implicated in this, made money off this same thing, that's typical of the situation in which no mention of this SNL scandal was brought up in the election in 1988. Why? Because Lloyd Benson is tarred with this. Lloyd Benson very obviously made money out of the SNL disaster, and yet he was a vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket in 1988, so he couldn't afford to have it brought up, so it wasn't brought up. And it's still not being brought up. And where is he going now? To the Treasury Department. And who was there when the mess took place? James Baker. And both of those people were involved in this disaster in Houston, Texas, in buying and selling savings and loans to the mafia.
Jack, what about foreign interests? We've talking about special interests in the United States being so heavily overrepresented and so powerful in Washington.
Well, those same lobbies are just as quick or maybe quicker to represent foreign interests because there's probably more money in the foreign interests. And therefore, foreign governments, Japanese and whoever else you might want to talk about, have better access to our representatives than we do.
A lot of the people on the Clinton staff and the transition team directly represent foreign interests, even though he said he criticized people for having foreign interests so powerfully represented in the Republicans.
Yeah, and they weren't exceptions. I mean, they were numerous. They were so numerous that it looks to me like it's clear that the Clinton administration is going to be business as usual. It's all for sale.
Well, the author of this, Who Will Tell the People, Grider, talks about, it's kind of like the macro level, what has happened as a result of all this, and it's really kind of scary. He says national sovereignty is going down the tube. Prosperity is gone for most of us. The middle class is wiped out. And social amity is gone.
The social contract is fading, and it's fading because the corporate interests seem to think that they can just kill the social agreement that they had between the corporate management, the workers, the consumers of the products, and the stockholders. We had to some extent a social fabric that included all those people and the ones who weren't even in the corporation. For years, we've thought that who lived in this country had a stake in this country. But now it's clear that if you don't have some kind of special stake that the international corporation wants or can use, you got no stake anywhere. And your wages are going to go down, your benefits are going to go down, your job possibilities are going to go down, and the international corporation doesn't think it has any responsibility. And of course, it may very well lessen that responsibility with these trade agreements.
Oh, gosh.
Because these trade agreements are going to make sure that they determine what it is they want to provide wherever they are.
And regardless of what people at the local, state, or national levels even want.
Well, that's right. And the problem's going to be that once you get locked into a trade agreement, then the trade agreement is too big and can be made up as too important for any one piece of it to be evaded.
And we've already seen that in the Republican administration, and also in the attitudes and some of the speeches and remarks of the Clinton people also.
Well, the scary part is that covered over with this whole attitude of tariffs and quotas and the usual trade barriers is the non-trade barriers. I mean, it's been a very slick ploy to hide these non-trade barriers, which are nothing more than evasions of certain kinds of corporate requirements and regulations, such as Clean Air Acts and other kinds of environmental arrangements, and safety requirements for labor. Yeah. These are all designed to be eliminated if the corporation wants to eliminate them.
In the Grider's chapter on class conflict, he talks about how the American people are very uncomfortable talking about class structure and their place in it.
Well, there's a lot of research on the class system in this country, and I've read a lot of it, and it kind of boils down to the question of not class systems, but status, and what indicates status, and what do people think about status, and it never gets down to the question of the power and the money elite in this country squashing the rest of us. It never gets down to that. And it also gets clouded up with the notion of, well, implicit in this is unionism. And, of course, we hate unions because unions are somehow, by definition, bad, and therefore we don't want to be associated with them. Therefore, that's a class, and we just don't even consider a possibility of a class structure being in place.
And they foment class divisions and class hatred. Remember during this election, every time that one of the candidates, particularly a Democratic candidate who was opposing Clinton for the nomination, every time they'd say something about how the people got screwed and just a lot of the things that we find in Grider's book, the media would immediately jump on him and say, oh, he's fomenting class hatred. I saw that all throughout the media.
Well, once again, the media itself is part of the problem. And the media is just one reason we're having all these concerns and these lacks of responsibility in the government. The mass communication has grown and proliferated. We've had a concentration of the media themselves. We've had a growth in the expertise business. the experts are the only ones that know anything because everything's too complicated for the rest of us dumb people. And the think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Foundation, the American Enterprise Corporation, the Manhattan Institute, all these so-called expert think tanks are paid for and bought by the corporate and the power system. And in effect, the opinions they deliver in terms of expertise always support the power system. And nothing else really is up for argument because there aren't any other system, there aren't any other experts out there countering them hardly.
So the people who are the power elite doing the work for the ruling class, they set the agenda for what you see on the media, what you are taught in school, what where philanthropy money will go for, the whole thing. It's all one big system. Until the American people realize this and face up to it, they're not even going to know what to oppose, much less be successful in struggling to make any change.
Well, there was a time there, of course, when those kinds of pseudo-agencies, expert agencies, didn't exist, and the two-party system kind of argued amongst themselves, and they had differences. But the two-party system doesn't have any meaning anymore, so it's gone. It's no longer a place that people can expect some kind of reaction. And then last, of course, in all of these problems that are getting us to this place where we're not represented and not paid any attention to, is the so-called global economy, in which everything is in terms of, oh, well, we got to compete with all those foreigners, so you got to get out of our way and let us do what we want to do the way we want to do it.
Free trade, that's shibboleth.
Free trade.
Well, Grider calls this the closet dictator.
The closet dictator is the global economy, and you always point to him as not letting you do things that you would do if you had to. And, of course, meaning you would allow democracy to operate in this country, but that old devil global economy won't let you.
There's a real good book, which I'm sure you've read, called Global Reach, which came out in the 70s, I guess it was, early 70s, talking about how the multinational corporations work and how they control things and how they have the people who run these corporations are strictly global. They have no loyalty to any government or any people in any nation. But they require absolute national loyalty from the rest of us when we are supposed to fight their wars or other things like this. But now, the global economy, instead of having multinational corporations with plants in one country and doing their trade, now it is a truly global factory where portions of certain segments of the production of a product are made in different countries, and then they're put together. It's been a revolution in that aspect.
Half of the Ford, the American-made Ford automobile is made in Japan, and the parts are shipped over here and put together over here. Same is true of the Toyota. There's hardly any difference between the Toyota and the manufacturing of a Toyota in this country and the Ford in this country. They're made from Japanese parts that were shipped over here.
Meanwhile, the American car manufacturers have large investments in Japanese car manufacturing companies. Most people don't realize that. But there's this book called The Work of Nations by Reich, and he talks about how this has become so atomized, and where you have, say, for instance, in one country they'll come up with a computer program, and then they'll have another country enter all this information into the various computer software, and then it's shipped somewhere else where the chips which are manufacturing in another country come in, and then it's assembled in another country. So national boundaries mean absolutely nothing anymore.
Well, they certainly don't in terms of where the jobs flow to, because they may be in one country for 2 or 3 years and move on to another country for another 2 or 3 years. And of course, manufacturing is the high paying jobs, and when the manufacturing jobs go, there's nothing left but service jobs. And service jobs, not only are they non-union, but they generally are low skill and therefore low paying.
Grider talks about a frightening aspect of this, and he says that the global economic order is producing global feudalism.
He calls it a form of feudalism because it's, in effect, nobody has any rights. Nobody but the very most powerful organizations and groups have any rights. Everybody else doesn't have any rights.
And working at semi-starvation wages,
or whatever they want to pay,
benefits.
And of course, the unions don't have any chance at all to get organized in a situation like this. And this is the aim. The aim is to let the corporation, Citizen General Electric, do what he wants to do, when he wants to do it, the way it wants to, whether it's a good idea or not. I mean, the man that runs General Electric is just another corporate flunky that rose up through the ranks by brown nosing. And who knows if the man really has any ability other than to figure out some way maybe to monopolize a trade and to make higher quarterly profits. But that's got nothing to do with the interest of the United States, hardly. And certainly not in terms of a political decision that might be made by General Electric, and they're made all the time.
I think we should mention that this, what we're talking about, is not just something that was hatched up during the Reagan-Bush years, but you see the seeds of it going way back to the American Revolution, where the group of people who were in the Continental Congress and who signed the Declaration of Independence were different people from those who sat in sealed secrecy in Philadelphia, who were drafting the Constitution of the United States. And because there was a tremendous class struggle at that time when the people from Philadelphia tried to get the Constitution passed, and they themselves said that the main thing they were trying to do with their Constitution was to protect their property and their power from the unwashed public. It is very obvious in what they said in the Federalist Papers. They said that it was an economic document, and they wanted to produce enough flaws so that the ordinary common people wouldn't be able to get their hands on the levers of power. And you see this happening all throughout American history, and even coming down into the great debate of the 60s and early 70s of the crisis of democracy, where the people in power, the book of the Trilateral Commission, said that democracy and capitalism are antithetical. You can't have them existing. And people have to accept a lessened role. People can't make any demands on the system, that the capitalists have to be in complete control. So you see this going all throughout American history, and we're really seeing it now.
Well, we had an example of this after World War I. When the business interests took over the country and ran it into the ground. And I thought we'd learn by then that you can't afford, even if these people weren't mostly or largely or to some extent corrupt, they certainly are mostly or partly or to some extent incompetent. And the combination is such that we can't have these people running things all the time, but that's what we've got. What I haven't been very much of a conspiracy theorist, but I see a conspiracy here. I see the goals and the means and the intent, and I see the people doing it. I see Grider lays it out. In effect, Grider has here a conspiracy theory in which the public will lose its power, and those people with money, an oligarchy, is going to take over. It's taken over, in effect. It's just a matter of whether it can be restored or not. He thinks it can be. He thinks democracy can be restored from the oligarchy it's turned into. That's certainly questionable.
Well, how does he say this is going to happen? How are people going to raise up in their wrath and throw the rascals out?
He doesn't exactly say that here's the way to throw the rascals out.
I mean, he thinks out like most liberals do when it gets down
to it. You bet. He's a gradualist kind of guy. He says, first you got to reassert your faith in democratic society.
Oh, hot
reassert
God.
Your faith. Then you got to become skeptical. He makes the point that most Americans, or a lot of Americans, are pretty tied to authority. Whatever authority says, that's what you expect. That's what you come to think is correct, and that's been the case.
True.
Saying we certainly need to get away from that, and I think that may be a fact that we're becoming less so. Then we need to have more local organization and more political involvement at the local levels, and of course the idea being that once you become active politically locally, that somehow spreads. I mean, how it's going to spread isn't clear, but that's the theory. And then finally, you just have to rebel against powerlessness, because that's what we're talking about. The public is powerless. It has no power, and you have to rebel against that. Well, hey, if you take that literally, a rebellion means you got to get tough. Yeah. And he doesn't talk very much about that, mm-hmm. and how tough you're going to get. You know, you just may have to come to push and shove, and people may have to go beyond what is thought of as normal bounds.
We talked a while ago about the huge tax breaks for the rich. Here's some more information on that subject.
We've done tons of stories on Alternative Views about how the rich and powerful looted the rest of us, as well as the Treasury, during the Reagan-Bush years, and even starting in the Carter years. So it was one of those nice bipartisan things that everybody likes to brag about. From the tax cuts from 77 through 81, according to an article in these Times, gave the rich so much money that their after-tax income jumped 136% in the 15 years because of these low tax rates. And the share of corporate tax collections also declined to such an extent that the revenue loss was $130 billion. The Citizens for Tax Justice in Washington, D.C., and their counterparts all around the country are organizing to see what they can do about this, to spread the word about what happened and to try to put pressure on congressional and state representatives. In a recent study by the CTJ, it was demonstrated that $80 billion in tax cuts for the richest 1% can explain the entire size of the federal budget deficit since 1977. So there's all this question about, well, what do we do? Well, it's easy. Clinton says those dread words to me, at least, well, we're all going to have to sacrifice. Well, we, you and I, the poor and the middle class, have sacrificed. As I think I agree with Jesse Jackson, who said, let those who had the party pay for it. Let's just put the tax burden back where it should be and where it was before this grand larceny took place.
This was class war in its most aggressive form. And so again, the only solution to this would be a radical revision of the whole tax system. So once again, there's a progressive income tax, and the rich pay their part, and the middle class and the poor get a tax break, which, by the way, is one of the major solutions to the deficit. So it's unbelievable that Clinton has not made a bigger deal about tax reform as part of the solution to what everyone agrees is the number one economic problem, the deficit. The only way to get big bucks to pay off the deficit is to tax the rich, as clear as can be.
Retax the rich.
To retax the rich, simply to move backwards to the pre-1977 tax code would go a long way in meeting the problem of the deficit. And for some reason, none of the politicians, including H. Ross Perot, has made this obvious point.
Yeah. That's what you made a point, alluded to a point about that happening and starting with Carter. Liberals and radicals are fond of foaming at the mouth against Reagan and Bush, but you seldom hear them make the point that so many of the things that occurred during those years started during the Carter years. Right. It just accelerated under Reagan and Bush.
And the question will be whether the Clinton years will be a replay of the Carter years.
Because Clinton is more conservative, actually, than Carter.
Or if there'll really be a change in the direction of policy to more equitable economics.
If you want to find out the condition of the U.S. banks and what's liable to be happening to them, you might take a look at dollars and cents for January of 1993. Particularly, it mentions a new study about the bank by Robert Vaughn and Edward Hill. It's published by Washington Post and is called Banking on the Brink. And it says that if the economy does not improve, that there may be as many as 1,200 troubled banks that are going to go belly up in the next few years. And these include some of the largest bank holding companies with $10 billion in assets or more. Now,
As a story from Mother Jones indicated several weeks ago, the Fed has tried to rescue the banks by pumping the bank profits up by having low interest rates, but giving the banks high interest rates on the treasury notes which they buy. So that spread between, say, the 3% that they might give anybody for CDs and the 7% which they're going to get from these treasury notes is a lot of money for the banks. But the banks are saddled with such problems that this is just a temporary infusion of blood, and they're going to continue to bleed. According to the FDIC's own estimates, that in 1993 it's going to lock the doors of 100 to 125 of the banks and cost $13 billion. But even mainstream bank economists say it's going to be much more than that. The FDIC, by the way, of course, is broke, and only with money from the government and some higher premiums charged to the banks as the FDIC being able to stay afloat. Well, Edward Kane, who's a finance professor at Boston College, says that the insurance fund that the FDIC has will need nearly $70 billion, not $45 billion the FDIC says it's going to need. Now, Vaughn and Hill, who wrote this Banking on the Brink, they think that it's going to be $59 billion, and maybe it's conceivable that the failures and arranged mergers could eventually cost $95.5 billion. Does this sound familiar? Remember how the savings alone was going to be just so much, then $50 billion, then $100 billion, then $200 billion, whereas our man, Rob Whittison, was saying it could be $1 trillion or maybe even $1.5 trillion, could go that high. Now, the FDIC is going to have to spend $10 billion to recover the deposits if just one of these huge banks fails, like Citicorp or Chase Manhattan. Now, regulators are pointing to the fact that they have helped the banks so far in the last part of 1992 and the early part of 1993. But Professor Kane told the Senate Banking Committee that favorable interest rate conditions are just masking the bank's current problems. They still have bad real estate. They still have junk bonds. They still have non-functioning debts to third world countries. Now, there's another catch to this banking thing. Actually, if there were honest accounting procedures that were followed, the banks had already be gone, because the Vaughn and Hill study said that there's an enormous discrepancy between the conventional bookkeeping and real economy. For instance, they're letting them, the current accounting rules permit the banks to keep on their books, evaluate these real estate loans at their book value, which they paid. These grossly inflated prices, which they paid during the big so-called boom. But now these things are worth maybe not even half that much, but they're still carrying as assets this inflated amount. So that if they actually had some real and honest accounting, most of these banks would be insolvent. And Vaughn and Hill say that 2,000 banks would probably go under if they, through one stroke, had some honest accounting. Oh, by the way, this Banking on the Brink by Roger Vaughn and Edward Hill is available from Washington Post Company Briefing Books.
The Clinton administration got a mandate for change, but whose mandate is it? Doug Henwood in the Left Business Observer reports that one private investor, Robert Wilson, said that the appointment of Lloyd Bentsen as Treasury Secretary was good for business because that means more loopholes. Well, you could drive a truck through some of these loopholes already. The special interests that Bentsen's most likely to serve are oil and gas, a natural for the native Texan, and real estate, since that's where his father, Lloyd Sr., made $100 million back in the 1950s. Bentsen's history as head of the Senate Finance Committee gives us a clue on what his policies will be like as Treasury Secretary. Generous tax breaks for business and savings incentives, that is, tax shelters for the wealthy or those wealthy enough to have savings. We can count on Benson, who in the 80s came out number one or two on almost every list of Political Action Committee recipients, to hand out subsidies to old friends and generally press for the continuation of supply-side economics, which was begun during the Reagan administration. Also, Lawrence Kudlow, a budget officer under Reagan, claims that Benson was pushing supply-side as early as the 1970s when everyone else thought it was nuts. Finally, Henwood reminded us that the senior fiscal officer of our nation, Lloyd Benson, once called George Bush, when he was in the Senate in the 70s, soft on the poor.
Oh, I saw a little statistic by somebody who had made a compilation of Lloyd Benson's voting record, and it seems that he went right down the line with Reagan-Bush administrations 47% of the time.
Right. It's a sign of the media in the United States, the mainstream media, and their lack of integrity or investigative zeal, that despite the fact that Lloyd Benson has been given one of the key economic posts in the Carter administration, no one has really investigated his background in any depth. No one has even looked at the book that Pete Bruton wrote, that we did a two-part interview with him on Alternative Views, to document the extent to which Benson was involved in the SNL scandal, how Benson sold his SNL operation, the family SNL, to organized crime, how his head of the Senate Finance Committee, Benson, didn't do anything to investigate in a rigorous way the SNL crisis or to do anything about it, how in 1988, when Dukakis was running for president and beginning to make some statements about the SNL crisis, Benson sent him a note saying, don't do this. This is not an issue that we can score points on. So there's just simply been none of the investigation of any of the positions that Pete Bruton has found in the mainstream media, despite the fact that this book has been out for a couple months now and seemingly known.
Before we leave you on Alternative Views, I'd like to share with you a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I've always known that heedless self-interest was bad morals. We now know that it is bad economics. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We would like to thank our crew for helping make our program possible. Brian Lynch and Ashley Blake for the interview with Jack Hopper, and Kevin L. West and Eric Eubank, who were our crew for the news segments. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.